Jesus tells in the parable of the sower how the seed of the word is assaulted by birds and weeds and sun.
Pastor Brian Wolfmiller, author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, A Martyr's Faith in a Faithless World.
This is the assault on our faith which the Lord wants to fight against and prevent. Some seed, that is, enduring faith, endures to the end, and the Lord teaches us how to have it in His Word.
Learn more about A Martyr's Faith in a Faithless World at issuesetc.org. I think it's widely recognized by Christians in the United States that our country is less friendly, if not to Christians, then to Christian beliefs than it ever was before. You could be a Christian, keep your mouth shut, though, and people will be very nice to you. If you happen to open your mouth and express your beliefs, like in favor of life or in favor of any of the Bible's moral teachings or other doctrines, you're likely to meet with some hostility. Now, that's kind of the atmosphere here, but there's also a legal framework, a policy framework that seems less friendly to Christians. Is there an answer to this much debated issue? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us to talk about Christian-friendly government policies, Lyman Stone, Senior Fellow at the Institute for Family Studies, Adjunct Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies and writes about demographics, family, and American culture. He and his wife serve as missionaries with the Lutheran Church Hong Kong Synod, and he's author of a recent column for The Federalist titled Four Ways to Use Government to Make America More Friendly to Christians. Lyman, welcome back.
Good to be here.
David French and Sohrab Amari recently held a debate at the Catholic University of America. Who are these two men, and what was the subject of their debate?
So David French is a religious liberty lawyer who specializes really in defending Christian groups when they are attacked on college campuses or churches or things like that. And Sohrab Amari is an opinion editor for the New York Post. And really, their debate was about how Christians can politically respond to an increasingly secular America. So Sohrab's take is that we need to sort of double down on advancing our religious views in politics, whereas David's view is that we need to defend sort of the general neutral liberal system and avoid imposing our religion, because kind of a liberal or neutral system is our only defense against a secularizing country.
So how does this debate represent a larger difference of opinion and approach in American Christianity?
So in theory, what the debate represents is on one side, David French saying, look, you know, Christians, they probably need to some extent keep their faith out of politics and just focus on defending the constitutional order, the general rights of all, and that will indirectly protect us in a way that is defensible in a secular society. And so that's kind of the traditional Lutheran position. That's generally been the view of most Lutherans as they engage in politics. On the other side, Sohrab Amari is looking at a culture that's changing very quickly, and a political culture that doesn't seem to be willing to leave Christians alone, and is really representing the opinion of Christians who are more gravely and, one could say, more emotionally concerned with the direction that politics are heading. That it seems like we might want to leave our faith out of politics, but our politics doesn't want to stay out of our faith. So he's saying, look, that's all well and good. It'd be nice if a neutral public sphere was going to work, but look, they're not going to leave us alone, so we got to fight fire with fire. So in some sense, it's really a debate about whether liberalism works at all, whether neutral public values function at all, or whether we kind of have to have a public religion.
You say that the real loser in the debate were Christians in America. Why is that?
Well, so they have this debate, which sounds like it should be really interesting. But at the end of the day, neither one of them really had anything substantive to say about what is actually to be done. That is, let's say both of them worry about declining religiosity in America. Both of them share that concern. And, you know, neither one of them are wanting to, like, you know, set up a monarchy in place of the Constitution. But neither one of them were very clear about, okay, so what are some policies we would actually like to see done that would actually plausibly have an effect on making it easier to be Christian in America, and therefore presumably increasing the number of Americans that are Christians? Neither of them really actually propose anything. They, you know, David wants to talk about free speech on college campuses, which is, a hot button issue, but doesn't actually really affect very many Americans. And Amari wants to talk about, you know, these hot button, more public morality issues like drag queen story hour, which, you know, is a ridiculous issue. But at the same time, again, it just isn't really affecting that many people. Neither one of them are really talking about things that are going to influence large numbers of Americans.
You summarize French's position as basically, in essence, saying if the Constitution functions and we encourage following the Constitution, it will provide protection for both Christians and for others. It's a solid enough document. What are the advantages to that approach? What are the shortcomings to that approach?
The big advantage is that it's acceptable in a non-Christian society. French's position is clearly aimed not so much at persuading Christians, but at persuading non-Christians. It's at saying, look, you might not believe our religion, but we all agree to these public values that we all respect each other. We play by the rules, so you play by the rules. That's its advantage. On the other hand, it does have a weakness that is not really designed to persuade Christians. It's not really persuasive to anybody who thinks that there is maybe this essential higher good. David plays really well in a non-Christian room, even though a lot of non-Christians might disagree for other reasons. They might say, well, you know, we're not going to just let hateful Christians spout their bigoted rhetoric. At the end of the day, he has a really strong argument in that room. In a Christian room, we say, well, look, free speech is great, but it's not the highest good to us. Good speech is the highest good, right? So it does not get the blood pumping, especially for a Christian audience.
You summarized Amari's position essentially as we need to double down on promoting our explicitly Christian values in law and in society. What are the advantages of that approach and its shortcomings?
Well, the advantage is that if it can be done and if it can be done successfully, the advantage should be, in principle, if we do it well, that we actually have more Christians in a society, in a society that's friendlier to Christians, a society that throws up less barriers to Christian life. That is an obvious good. We all want that. We all want a society where there are more people, more believers able to live faithful lives. The downfall, of course, is that that's easier said than done. Imposing Christianity by legal fiat is not going to work. It's also not good, not an acceptable way. It's not an acceptable form of evangelism. And beyond that, it can easily backfire. If you try to force people to adopt a religion, they may not like it, and they may respond aggressively. So it is a very high risk, though potentially high reward approach.
Why do you think it is that neither approach, at least in the case of French and Amari, are offering concrete solutions or steps toward a more Christian-friendly America?
I think in both cases, it's because they are both men of particular expertise. They are not policy wonks, so to speak. It's not their job. This is not what they do. They don't spend their day thinking about political religious demography. That's just not their job. So they're out there having a neat philosophical argument, whereas there's a policy discussion on the side that they're just manifestly unqualified to have. So for us to really see which one of these positions might be more viable, we need to have folks who are able to have that argument.
You say that there are solutions. You suggest several, beginning with, and I think people might find this rather shocking, the reinstatement of blue laws. Explain what blue laws are for those who didn't grow up with them like I did. And why would you suggest they be reinstated?
So my interest here is in trying to nudge this debate a bit farther along and say, look, I might not be the world's leading expert on this either, but we should at least start to have some conversations around some possible policy options. And one of them I give is these blue laws. And blue laws is just a term for laws restricting certain types of businesses on Sundays. So most commonly are restricting alcohol sales, but there are other forms of blue laws. Many states restrict hunting on Sundays. Some states restrict a lot of retail on Sundays. I grew up in an area that had a lot of blue laws. I grew up actually in a dry county, and I grew up in a family where I was prohibited from doing homework on Sundays. I was prohibited from doing any sports on Sundays. We were pretty intense Sabbatarians, I guess. The question is, if we made more laws restricting what businesses can be open on Sundays, what would this do? And there's actually a lot of research on this. There's a lot of academic research on blue laws, on what happens when they're, especially when they are repealed, because they've been being repealed all around the country for decades. And the answer is, after blue laws are repealed, religious participation declines, voter participation declines, drunk driving increases, alcohol-related deaths increase. It has a lot of negative impacts on society. It turns out banning a lot of different types of commerce, and especially alcohol, one day a week, has a lot of very positive impacts on society. Now, it does make it hard to have those mimosas at Sunday brunch, but it does end up with actually more people going to church. It ends up with more people participating in many different forms of civil society, including voting, and it saves lives.
Lyman Stone is our guest. We're talking about Christian-friendly government policies. When we come back, how do the current laws and regulations penalize marriage?
Jesus tells in the parable of the sower how the seed of the word is assaulted by birds and weeds and sun.
Pastor Brian Wolfmiller, author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, A Martyr's Faith in a Faithless World.
This is the assault on our faith which the Lord wants to fight against and prevent. Some seed, that is, enduring faith, endures to the end, and the Lord teaches us how to have it in His Word.
Learn more about A Martyr's Faith in a Faithless World at issuesetc.org.
What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's a monthly magazine on faith and life, theology and culture that helps readers interpret the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective. Filled with expert insights, good writing, and inspiring stories, it also provides essential church information for LCMS members. What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's the flagship periodical of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and it has been for more than a century. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today.
Your lifeline to the Lutheran worldview. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Recently graduated from high school or college and looking for a chance to serve a community in need while sharing the good news of Jesus Christ? Lutheran Young Adult Corps may be for you. Lutheran Young Adult Corps provides opportunities for long-term, full-time service for 10 weeks through the summer or 10 months over the school year in places like St. Louis, Philadelphia, and Boston. Find out more about Lutheran Young Adult Corps by finding us online at lcms.org/YACORPS or on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Lutheran YA Corps.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. On this Friday, September the 27th, we're talking about Christian-friendly government policies. Lyman Stone is our guest, author of a recent column for The Federalist titled, Four Ways to Use Government to Make America More Friendly to Christians. Lyman, how do current laws and regulations penalize marriage?
So this is an area that, that I'm really passionate about, and I've actually testified before Congress about, is that we currently make it very hard for working class people to get married. So if you're middle class, the marriage penalty is pretty modest, depending on what your incomes are. But for working class people, they can lose thousands or tens of thousands of dollars of tax benefits and welfare benefits if they get married. That basically, when we calculate people's eligibility for welfare, we do it based on the assumption that there will only be one earner in the household. If there are two earners in the household, you generally lose your welfare, which is a way of saying that if two working class people get married, they lose their benefits. This is a way of saying that we punish marriage. Well, you get married, okay, we're going to yank thousands or tens of thousands of dollars. So there's many situations where working class people will actually be poorer if they get married. This discourages marriage, and because it discourages marriage, it discourages our religiosity, because we know that being married makes people more likely to express religious beliefs and to attend religious activities. There's a lot of research suggesting that marriage makes people more religious. This is a pretty significant thing. A lot of the decline in religion has been among less educated, lower earning Americans. And those are also the people we've seen the biggest decline in marriage among. And these are also the people that have had the biggest increase in the government-imposed barriers to marriage. So I think it's a pretty reasonable supposition that these government barriers to working-class marriage are actually a part of what is driving the growing secularization of America's working class.
You suggest a parenting wage. What is that and why?
So I say a parenting wage. What I really mean here is just generous public support for childbearing. So you could do it as a bigger tax credit for kids. You could do it as a new benefit. You could do it as like a big baby bonus that you get when the baby is born. Different countries do this different ways. What I'm really saying is we should give more explicit financial support to having babies. And my reasoning on this is, one, America's birth rate is very low. We talked about this a few weeks ago when I came on the show, when we might want to do something to raise our birth rate, and this will increase fertility. But also, when we increase fertility, it turns out there's a lot of academic research that suggests that being religious makes you more likely to have babies, but also that having babies makes you more likely to become religious. That is, that childbearing alters people's attitudes towards religion. But both sides of this equation are actually important for our purposes. On the one hand, we want to say we want to make it easier to live a Christian life. Well, Christians are more likely, we have more babies than non-religious people, so a bigger child benefit is more likely to provide support for Christian families. And on the other hand, it's also more likely to cause lots of people of any religion to have babies, and having babies is more likely to make them become religious. And actually, it's worth noting, there's biblical support for this idea, right? Paul specifically talks about this with women. He says that they will be saved through childbearing, which is a passage that, as moderns, we like to skip. Of course, you could also argue that maybe men are saved by fatherhood, right? It makes us better. But there's biblical support for the idea. This is not just a purely strategic thing. Scripture is pretty clear that having children alters your outlook on the world and on God. So we might want to support that. This is something maybe worth doing.
What about immigration? You say we should be encouraging it.
Yeah. So this one is I know, a bit of a mind bender for a lot of conservatives and Christians who look at immigration and say, man, I don't see how more immigrants are going to make the country more Christian. And this one's a bit tricky because the average immigrant is considerably more conservative than the average American in terms of their social values. Now, a lot of them are non-Christian. They are conservative Muslims, or they are conservative Asians. And a growing share of America's immigration is coming from people coming for our universities. And people coming for university are more likely to be progressive. If you really want to get very conservative immigrants, and particularly Christian conservative immigrants, then you would really want to pull immigrants through, we could introduce like a new visa program for formerly colonized countries. This would pull disproportionately from Africa, South Asia, and Southeast Asia. South and Southeast Asia are mostly Hindu or Buddhist, and also some Muslims. But Sub-Saharan Africa, which would be the big source of immigrants under such a program, is overwhelmingly Christian. And these countries are all very conservative. They're places where people basically agree with American Christians about abortion, about marriage, about the importance of children, about stable family life, about all these things. So these are cases where we really would like to have reinforcements, moral reinforcements from these countries, because they're people who will help us advance our vision of a good society in a country where many Americans are increasingly agents of secularization. So many conservatives will tend to see immigrants as reinforcements for the political left. That's because on economic issues, they often are. Immigrants are often more economically left-leaning than many Americans. But on social issues, they tend to be more conservative. And if we're pulling from sub-Saharan Africa, they're overwhelmingly likely to be Christian. And so I would say we should lean into that. We should say, okay, yeah, we might make some trade-offs on economic policy, but the Bible doesn't set an ideal tax rate. The Bible does, however, make pretty clear that we shouldn't be murdering the unborn. So I'm willing to bring in a lot more sub-Saharan Africans who are going to agree with me about the unborn and who might, you know, they might vote for higher taxes. And, you know, we'll deal with that when the time comes. But I think we need to be recruiting moral reinforcements through immigration.
Finally, you say it's not about public morality, obscenity, or Christian values at all. Trying to force Christian values on Americans will not work and very well may backfire, accelerating secularization. What do you mean by that?
There's a lot of research on determinants of religiosity. And they find that when a country imposes an official state religion, it tends to reduce religious behavior and belief. There's also findings suggesting that when state religions are removed, it tends to increase religiosity and religious and expressions of religious belief. There's research on the rise of political LGBT interest groups around the country. And there's a finding, and it's still debated, it's still kind of preliminary, but there's a suggestion that the states where LGBT interest groups became most influential during the 1990s especially are actually the states where religious conservatives were the most active during the 1990s. There is a lot of research on backlash. There's a lot of research suggesting a lot of people are leaving the church now because of basically arguments about public morality. That is, arguments about same-sex marriage and other sort of public morals issues. The truth is these are losing issues for Christians. Trying to persuade a non-Christian society to live under a Christian moral code is biblically backwards and also just ineffective. We know that the world is not going to live as we live. It's not going to happen. Instead of arguing about how to have a Christian veneer on a non-Christian society, which is a losing battle, instead we should focus our public efforts on public policies that can be acceptable in a secular society, but which are likely to create a more Christian society.
Lyman Stone is Senior Fellow at the Institute for Family Studies, Adjunct Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies and writes about demographics, family, and American culture. He and his wife serve as missionaries with the Lutheran Church Hong Kong Synod, and he's author of a recent column for The Federalist titled Four Ways to Use Government to Make America More Friendly to Christians. Read it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Lyman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Terry Mattingly is with us to talk about a Washington Post story about the future of the Boy Scouts after this.
Daily exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you appreciate Issues Etc., talk radio for the thinking Christian, and Lutheran Public Radio, sacred music for the world, please include a bequest in your will or trust for these worldwide media resources. Bequests aren't subject to federal tax or capital gains taxes. Ensure your children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren the opportunity to listen by including a bequest in your will or trust for Issues Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio.